This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're joined by Mark Watney. He's the president of the North Dakota Farmers Union. We're going to talk about a number of developments, most recently the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, number two, I guess. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
I just referred to the Coronavirus Food Assistance Program, which was just announced last week. How might it benefit growers in North Dakota?
Well, it's a pretty good package in a sense of that we're going to get cash in the hands of farmers and ranchers when they need it. Obviously, these programs get written somewhat behind the doors. We get influence on the dollars, but we don't really get a lot of input on what they structure them like. So what we're hearing is there'll be some dollars for just about all commodities. There should be some slight corrections to some of the distributions from before. And we're hoping that we can spread it across more commodities across North Dakota. So they need cash, and this is a help in cash, and hopefully it can help them get through the harvest and into next year.
So it's about $14 billion nationwide. How does it fill in the gaps of that first COVID assistance program?
Well, it really does on the spread of the commodities that are covered. And in some of the calculations, it's going to help with that. And hopefully it's going to shift it to the areas that need a little bit more assistance than got before. The cattle, it's going to take a new inventory window at time and hopefully pick up some of the folks that just got missed by that inventory cycle last time. They got real small payments. Again, I don't want to suggest this thing is perfect. It's far from that. But we're about trying to get money out in this time of poor trade negotiation and with the epidemic.
Well, how has the pandemic affected North Dakota's ag economy overall? What's your perspective on the destruction it's caused?
Yeah, well, what it's done is in a time of fairly large supplies, building up, again, starting with trade wars and then having the scenarios play out where there's, you know, people not really buying food, restaurants closures, all those things have taken away our demand. And when you do that, we sit on stocks that are going to harm us over time to get our prices back at a more reasonable level. And when that happens, it's really tough because it lasts for a long period of time. And I know people don't understand that, but it's tough with, as a farmer, and you know we need food in the world, yet you're getting penalized because there's too much food. So it's just a bad scenario that plays out.
So in the past couple of years, we've heard reports of farmers adding storage for crops in hopes of better prices. Is that still happening? Is that part of this problem?
It definitely is. I mean, there's even in the, you know, in the livestock industry, you can't hardly get a steer or a cow in to be butchered simply because they're out 6 months to a year. And the meat industry isn't fully back to par yet. So we're still, you know, storing things that have to go to market, which disrupts the chain down the road.
Well, in the last couple of times you and I have talked, we've talked about the trade issue, particularly the trade dispute with China. There have been announcements about agreements to ease that dispute with China. Are North Dakota farmers selling more soybeans and other commodities to China, or is that not apparent yet?
Yeah, well, no, we're seeing some movement. We've actually seen some additional corn and wheat. I don't think we're going to achieve the goals of the Phase 1 trade agreement. The interesting thing, if you look at the overall challenges, we're running a substantial egg trade deficit, which means that's really different than normal. We've almost always had a surplus in egg trade, which helps set off the other deficits in trade. And I don't know if that'll get corrected by the year end or not, but that would be unusual where we're importing more food than we're exporting.
If you compared this year with years past, is it average or below? How would you characterize it for those of us who don't farm?
Well, we've been since about 2013, 2014, we've been in a downhill farm income level of income. So this year we are actually projected to be up somewhat. So you could suggest that's a little better. But the challenge there is I think we're going to end up at maybe 40, 42-43% of our income coming from the federal government, which is simply what, you know, the taxpayer doesn't want and the farmer doesn't want, but it's really the only way that we can survive. So I think it's worth doing. It's just a question of how do we get that market back so the farmers get it from the marketplace.
What confluence of circumstances would get us back to a robust farm economy?
Well, we're going to have to really look at our farm bill to create some type of an atmosphere where it represents cost of production and get away from ad hoc disaster type programs or food assisted type programs. So with that, then you would have our federal government working to create demand. So it's renewable fuels, it's ethanol, it's working out strong trade deals that actually function in the interest. We need to get the concentration out of all the places we buy our inputs from, our transportation system, and our obviously the beef slaughter, our processing industry is just hugely taking advantage of both the consumer and the farmer. So all these little things that we've let slide over the years and haven't enforced the laws around are starting to haunt us. And of course, you put a pandemic and a trade war on top of it, and it just makes it look that much worse.
Well, the Trump administration was getting a little bit of fire, too, from people who grow for ethanol because of some concessions made to refiners. Has that been worked out at all? Is the sort of the disagreement, if you will, between fossil fuel and renewable ag fuel simmering down?
Well, the battle continues. He did make a concession with EPA coming out and not allowing for the small waivers for the small refiners, which was being abused totally. So that'll help somewhat for demand for ethanol. But, you know, there was words of potentially using USDA money to pay the crude oil producers to some $300 million. I guess that went away yesterday. So that's the good news. But what we're really missing, and I wish some administration or somebody in this administration would understand that really the competition for crude oil is electric. And if you don't adopt to have some ethanol or biodiesel or soy oil or canola oil and make the crude oil substantially better for the atmosphere, they're going to lose. So instead of thinking so short term, they should be trying to clean up that crude oil, because there's a lot of consumers in other parts of the country that are going to demand that. And if we don't change, they're going to actually go to electric, which, again, will be a detriment to the crude oil industry.
Early in the pandemic, we were reminded of how reliant we are on a few meatpacking operations across this country. We had, I think, Smithfields in Sioux Falls, for example, was decimated for a while. Lots of their workers became ill with the coronavirus. And in July, you had a news release that was very critical of the way the beef packing industry is structured. What changes would you like to see in that business?
Well, what we really need is to take the Grain and Stockyards Act and the antitrust laws and enforce the laws. Back in the mid-1900s, when the lamb slaughter got down to or as high as 40%, they broke them companies up. Now we got four companies owning about 82-83% of the whole beef processing, and they've just taken this thing over to a point where they can do these monopolistic practices. So we got to stop that. And that means getting back some local beef processors. It means some farmer cooperative processing. It means some public partnerships with private industry to spread out those processing facilities in other parts of the country. We need labeling laws corrected. I mean, right now the voluntary USA label is being misused because these same beef processing plants are importing products and just slightly modifying it to a point where they're saying it's a U.S. product. All these things are things we've just ignored, and we've done it in the interest of these businesses being profitable, and we just gave them everything they could have, and now the consumer pays more and the rancher gets less. It's just the wrong way to do it.
Mark Watney is the president of the North Dakota Farmers Union. Mark, you were just talking about the integration of the beef industry right now. And let's look at value added. Is there room for meat packing in North Dakota? Because such a small percentage of the beef that's raised here is processed here.
Well, I really do believe there's room for it. But if we don't address the monopolies out here, if we don't address this 85 or 84% ownership by a China company, a Brazil company, and two U.S. companies, then we're going to have to fix the antitrust laws and make it so new companies can start in this line of business without that severe competition from the companies that are practicing this monopolistic stuff.
Meat is inspected in the state of North Dakota. Can it be sold in another state, or is there some sort of law that has to be changed there?
There is some rules that got to be changed to be able to sell across state lines and being able to go into, you know, a restaurant and a grocery store. That varies by state quite a bit. And again, when you have to deal with all them different rules, it can get quite expensive if you've got a small facility that's maybe doing a 10 head a day or less. So yeah, we need to address that. Really the safety issue wasn't around necessarily the small processors. A lot of times it comes from the big guys, and then it gets substantially broader spread before it's caught because they're pushing so much product through. So yeah, we need to work on all these laws, and we really need to work on getting them large companies take their way their advantage to be able to manipulate the market.
Now, you talked about when you get to the USDA and you get to a farm bill or ag policy, sometimes the heads in the room aren't necessarily the farmers who are involved. So do farmers actually have the political clout to change the status quo? What we were just talking about, meat packing, or talking about the cost of production in terms of figuring out how to support agriculture in our country.
You know, I think we do if we come together. Our organization really works hard on this stuff, and I feel pretty proud that we've been able to work with our Senator Colvin primarily, but our other congressional folks in getting a lot of the dollars and rewriting the rules to get more money back into the state of North Dakota. So it can be done. You just simply need to really work hard, and you need to tell the stories right. And it certainly has the attention. Now, we've been on 2-3 lawsuits. We've encouraged our attorney general to be part of going after the beef industry. I think that if enough pressure comes, we'll see change. But it's a will thing. I mean, if the administration, whoever wins elections, has to have some will to go out and do that hard work. And as of late, we tend to fall on the side of let the corporate world win and, your shareholders get more money and the stock market looks stronger. But that doesn't translate always perfectly back to the common ordinary person that's not in the stock market. So I'm hopeful we can get it done, but it's certainly not easy.
About 60 years ago, I think the Farmers Union would have been perhaps the most potent political force in the state of North Dakota. Since then, there's been considerable consolidation. The number of farmers and the size of farms has changed remarkably. How would you assess your organization's political clout now?
Well, it varies by how each election goes somewhat, but we are in a lot of polls, whether it's the Dems or Republicans doing a poll. They'll sometimes look at, Farm Bureau stuff or Farmers Union stuff. And what I see coming out of polls is we're 60-70% in a popular poll of people think they agree with our policies. So to me, that makes it pretty strong. We also have nearly 50,000 members. So we're still the largest farm organization in North Dakota. And we obviously have both Democrats, Republicans. We're extremely nonpartisan. We're very political. People confuse partisan with political a lot. We're active, but we don't endorse candidates. The farm organization does not donate to any candidate either. We simply work with who gets elected and put forward the policies our members pass. So I find that to be a good tool and a good way to do it for for what we want to accomplish.
How would you prioritize the political objectives of the organization right now? After all, we are going into an election.
Yeah. Well, in the federal level, it's farm income and, you know, making some sense out of our marketplace. So we'll be digging in after election right into anything that can enhance farm income and kind of clean up these markets. On state levels, we're going to work pretty hard on livestock processing and trying to find an avenue, because beef is so important to North Dakota. It's time that both the public sector and the private sector step up and find an avenue where we can make the beef industry much stronger in North Dakota. So that's our two big priorities at the moment.
Now, we had NAFTA, which was replaced by this new trade agreement for Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. They're two very important trading partners with them. How has the pandemic affected the flow of trade across those borders?
Yeah. In some respect, I can't say there's been a huge impact from an agriculture perspective. Even the USMCA really wasn't anything tremendously changed, at least from the North Dakota into Canada or Canada into North Dakota. It's very similar to the old NAFTA. But the fact that you can't cross the borders, the fact that you can't do business, that I think that's really been a negative thing overall. So it's a broader than that for our exports. We really need the Asia market. We need Japan. We need China. All those things are the areas that really impact North Dakota.
China's been taking a lot of steps lately that seem to indicate that they want to diversify their source of supply, particularly for soybeans. They've been, I think, talking to the Russians. I don't know how sophisticated the Russians are with soybeans. They've been dealing with Brazil. Considering how important soybeans have been to growers in our part of the country, how threatened is that market, that commodity?
Oh, I think the steps we made and took China on alone and they retaliated on soybeans was probably not the best move from the soybean perspective. And China's been doing tons of things to try to become substantially more self-sufficient. I serve on a World Farm Organization where I travel and get to see things that happen in other countries. And I mean, in Africa, China's buying land. They're obviously developing their own genetics. They're doing a lot of work in trying to produce substantially more of their own food. So what we did is we encouraged them to do that. So now the question is will they ever get their production levels up to where they won't need as much imports? And then who are they going to buy from? And they built some pretty good export infrastructure down in Brazil. So, they're smart people. I think we sometimes take for granted what they think like. And part of why they've been buying so much is the price was low enough. And I'm fearful that they bought at a low price and they're going to start backing away simply because the price started to climb a little bit.
Well, I've done a fair amount of traveling in Africa, and I can tell you that the Chinese are building roads like nobody's business. And they're building them in countries like Uganda, where they're incurring these countries are incurring huge debts. They owe China billions of dollars. And I suspect the Chinese will get something out of that.
Well, I would guess so. And I mean, they got a lot of people to feed. And, we can argue whether we like the communist way they run their government. I'm not by any means. But they control it and can find avenues to feed their people, keep them happy, and keep them, with their thumb on them in that style of government, they're going to do it. And I guess because an untapped market for them to garner products.
I saw another news release that caught my eye, and that is that the Farmers Union has a youth camp and they're building a new one. I didn't realize that you had this long history with summer activities for farm kids and others. Tell us about this new facility near the Jamestown Reservoir.
Yeah, we've really always been in youth education. We teach the cooperative business model. We teach leadership development and civic duties and really develop some strong leadership of it, not just for our organization, but people that, want to serve on boards, school boards, maybe county commissioners or wherever. And we've been just really successful as of late in recruitment, approaching about 1,200 kids a year. So, that forced us, we have one camp in Western North Carolina. We've been leasing camp spaces, and that except we tended to get the weeks of time when they weren't using. With the second camp, we'll be able to grow to a couple thousand kids. We're going to have a beautiful location up on the Jamestown Reservoir, and we'll have some state-of-the-art technological training rooms, and we're just step up the effort, and hopefully we're running a couple thousand kids through our program starting next summer.
Now, did this year's camp have to be canceled due to COVID?
We went with about a 50% attendance. We isolated and separated and ran about 450 kids compared to about 1,200. Didn't have any real issues notification of a close contact towards them, so we did stop our last camp just to things, but no, we were pretty much incidence free, so I'm happy we were able to help for a little bit. Hopefully this thing will start to settle down again.
Well, Mark Watney is president of the North Dakota Farmers Union, and Mark, always appreciate having some time with you to talk about these issues that lots of people in our state are dealing with day to day.
Yeah.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
Hi, I'm Tom Brousseau. October is full of nice surprises on the next Great American Folk Show. We've got North Dakota music royalty, Chuck Suki.
Saturday night, beneath the prairie moonlight, you could hear the accordion call.
The California via South Dakota folk noir of Suzanne Valley.
Wind favors, upskirts, savors, drinks with flavors, suntan craves. Rescue towers, cowboy singers, good time bringers, rhinestone slingers. How is you?
And the soulful, sultry country blues of Lisa Sanders.
And I can't stop the shaking.
You'll also hear from two poets. One is from South Central Los Angeles, California. Her name is Bridget Bianca. And the other, let's just say that he's a part of the Haight-Ashbury movement, San Francisco, California, in the early 60s, Gino Skye. Plus, Z-maker Jonas Cannon, folk artist Angelina Elise, and more notes from the Badlands from our very own Joe Wiegand. Fall into another delightful episode of the Great American Folk Show, Sunday, October 4th at 5 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Mountain on Prairie Public.
Coming up on Main Street, a report from Harvest Public Media about efforts in Oklahoma to help farmers who've lost traditional markets get their food to those who need it most. And Sue Balcom will join us for Main Street Eats, and Tom Ezern will share a Plainsfolk essay. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Native American groups now hope the president will sign a measure designed to help law enforcement get a handle on a public safety issue plaguing tribal communities. The bill was inspired by the murder of a North Dakota woman 3 years ago. Earlier this week, Congress gave final approval to Savannah's Act, which addresses cases of missing and murdered indigenous people. It orders the Justice Department to develop guidelines to solve and prevent these cases while establishing data collection. Lisa Casares of North Dakota Native Vote says the public finally is noticing that Natives are easily targeted for horrific crimes, and this will hopefully bring some solace.
It's considered positive, considering, you know, this has been a long-standing issue within Indian country that, you know, the missing and murdered Indigenous women and Indigenous people.
The bill is named after Savannah Graywind, a pregnant Native American woman who was brutally murdered in 2017. Her body was found along the North Dakota-Minnesota border. Indigenous women face more violence than any other group. The National Institute of Justice says at least 84% of these women have been the target of sexual or other violence in their lifetimes. Not only does the law require federal officials to establish guidelines for these cases, it also instructs them to increase communication with tribal authorities. Casares says she hopes there's more accountability for federal agencies, especially since tribal governments have faced restrictions in investigating crimes committed against their people by outside offenders.
A lot of jurisdictional, confusion and issues between laws as they apply on the reservation to tribal members and non-tribal members or don't apply.
And the director of Fargo Cass Public Health says she agrees with Governor Burgum. Desi Fleming says people have grown tired of the months-long messaging on COVID-19 and have slipped on some of the recommended prevention guidelines.
That COVID fatigue where people want desperately for this to go away. They want to be back to normal. And I think sometimes when you're in that mindset and you're just kind of exhausted, you kind of tend to let your guard down a little bit. And so I think that we've gotten a little bit complacent with some of our prevention strategies.
Cass County, with a rising number of positive tests, has been placed on the moderate or yellow alert level. Fleming says while long-term care continues to be a concern, the virus spreads easily among younger, more active adults, with case numbers up among 15 to 29-year-olds. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Every relationship has its own obstacles, but what if the person you're committing your life to has been sentenced to life without the possibility of parole? On the next Snap Judgment, an Ear Hustle special, Hold That Space. Snap Judgment. Do not miss it.
Saturday at 5 Central, 4 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. COVID-19 has made it more difficult for farmers to sell produce at farmers' markets or to restaurants. As a result, food is being left in the fields. Harvest Public Media's Seth Bodine reports on how one group in Oklahoma is helping farmers get that food from their fields to those who need it most.
While coronavirus has hampered farmers this year, usually it's the weather that threatens crops. Last year, Joe Tierney's farm was in trouble. Heavy rain was causing flooding all along the Arkansas River. Before he knew it, the water from the nearby creek was creeping forward.
There's really not anything you can do except just watch it.
Tierney had to evacuate the farm, leaving behind his field full of vegetables. That's when he called for help. Katie Plohockey is visiting the farm again. She remembers looking at the fields in jeopardy.
Just romaine lettuce the size of my torso that was growing, and just all of these rows, and to know that it was going to be underwater in 2 days and all of that was going to be ruined.
Plohockey founded the Health Community Store Initiative, an effort to bring fresh produce to food deserts in Tulsa. The mission was simple: rescue as many cabbages as possible and bring them to those in need before all the leafy goods were underwater.
You know, I went and actually leased a U-Haul truck just so I could, you know, get it all, because time was of the essence.
Plohockey brought back 4 truckloads of cabbage and lettuce to the group's mobile grocery store. That cabbage rescue mission is part of Hands to Harvest. It aims to reduce food waste by getting volunteers to pick the excess food off the field, and not just during disasters. It's a practice called gleaning. The tradition goes back to biblical times. There are similar programs all over the country. Plohockey says farmers often recognize there's extra food in the fields, but getting it off the farm can be difficult.
The farmers don't have the manpower or the time to load it up and deliver it somewhere. And so there's a missing link in between the farm and the pantries or the food banks or the schools or whoever needs that food. And so that's what we were trying to do, is just fill in that gap a little bit.
Sean Peterson founded the Association of Gleaning Organizations. He says the COVID-19 pandemic isn't a crisis for them, but now there's a lot more food to pick up.
There's so much more produce because of disruptions in the systems, whether it's the restaurants that were closed that the small-scale farmer can't sell to now, or, you know, schools that were closed that the large-scale farmer can't sell to.
Excess food on the farm is actually pretty common, even during normal times. Research from Santa Clara University estimates that about a third of crops grown on U.S. farms go unharvested. Greg Baker is a professor at Santa Clara University. He says farmers often will only let gleaners into the field after the very last harvest.
They can't afford to have someone who is not well-trained come into their field and do something wrong, you know, like not wash their hands after using the toilet, and then possibly, you know, contaminate an entire field.
Gleaning isn't the only strategy Plohockey is using to combat food waste while keeping people fed. When the Tulsa Farmers Market closed, she says she was buying produce directly from the farmers. That food went to her program's COVID-19 grocery relief program.
It's just making that connection between, you know, who's growing the food and who's needing the food, because there should be no one in the United States that should be food insecure.
While gleaning won't solve food insecurity, Plohacky says it's one way to get fresh food to people who need it. Seth Bodine, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that focuses on America's farm and rural issues. Coming up, Main Street Eats.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas, Director of Radio at Prairie Public. I want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people who have contributed during our fall membership drive here at Prairie Public. And without you, we could not do it. We had donations from across the region of all different levels, and we're sending out Prairie Public face masks to everybody who donated, and some people won some great prizes. So we had a lot of fun, and we're so happy to hear from you during this unusual time with so much news going on. We actually reduced the total amount of time that we spent talking about the drive because there was so much news going on, but you came through anyway, and we appreciate it. If you haven't had a chance to donate and want to, you can still participate in the fall drive for a couple more days by calling 800-359-4145 or going to prairiepublic.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. And because it's Thursday, it's time for Sue Balcom and Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Always my pleasure.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. And Sue, tis the season of apples everywhere.
Oh, yes. And my son has an apple tree that produced so many apples last year that I was banking on those apples this year. And he's like, well, there's not quite so many apples this year. And I said, yeah, that's kind of how it goes. I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool to make a jelly and call it Adam's Apple Jelly?
Oh, mm-hmm.
Because that's my son's name.
Adam's
that
Apple? That's an incredible
Isn't
name.
Isn't that cool? I know, right? Adam's Apple, the man
you
of
should
red
do
earth.
It. Yeah, make that your next big famous thing at your farmer's markets.
Yeah, and you know, farmer's markets have been going so well this year that people are stocking up their root cellars. But I find that apple season is the best, like caramel apples.
Oh,
or
thanks.
Apple crisp.
Yes.
Or apple pie.
Keep going.
But you know,
yep.
I used to... Yeah, well, when I worked at the newspaper in Mandan, I would walk to the store every day and eat an apple because, as you know, you were probably told when you were young that an apple a day keeps the doctor away. And this comes from a Pembrokeshire proverb that originated in 1866, which I actually like better. It's called "Eat an apple on going to bed, and you'll keep the doctor from earning his bread."
Was the doctor a barber back then?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know, man. Yeah, right? That would be scary. But, you know, eating apples is good for you, not necessarily with all that sugar in there. And, of course, there are many, many different kinds of apples. I prefer the ones off the oldest apple trees I can find. They have flavor like none of the new hybrids
do. They're so wise.
They're so good. They have such a wild, wild taste to them or something. You have a wonderful tree, don't you?
I do, yeah. And I have no idea what kind of apples they are, but they are a little bit extra sweet after that first frost. Like, they're kind of mid-October apples.
I'm a crab apple fan myself. I like a little tart apple.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes, and you know, after the frost, they really get better. My grandmother had a tree that had these little crabs on it. She canned them. She would can the whole apple, and they were delightful. And I can't figure out how she did it, because the last time I did that, they completely turned to mush.
Huh. Strange.
So it might have been the kind of apple, you know, like there's certain eating apples, and then there's baking apples. And some of those nice, big, crisp, tart apples are the best for pie. Because, you know, I like it a little tart, then you put a little vanilla ice cream on it, and evens it out.
All over. Yeah.
Well, my favorite of those apples is the Granny Smith. So let's talk about baking apples.
Well, there's a couple new kinds out there, like Jazz, and Cameo that are also good for baking. The thing about Granny Smith is you could actually eat those as well as bake with them. And they're such a beautiful color green.
Yeah.
You'll always know a Granny Smith because they never get red. And of course, once they're in a pie, you don't care what color they are. So, you know, cinnamon colored. But then they have all, I love Honeycrisp apples. We had a Honeycrisp tree that produced the most wonderful eating apples. That apple tree was actually developed in Minnesota through extension, I believe.
Yeah.
And that is right up there with Pink Ladies, which are pretty good too.
Yeah. Can you tell by look or by just easy touch if it's a baking apple or just a regular eat out of hand apple or what have you, ones that are going to be more tart versus more sweet? Or do you have to either memorize that list or bite into it?
Baby. Okay. So, and you always want to pick out a firm apple, of course. Mushy apples are not on my radar, and we know which brand are more mushy. Oh, applesauce is good. Yes. But you know, in addition to like eating an apple a day is probably good for you. But, you know, eating too many, they say, would probably introduce too much fiber into your diet. But I find that really hard to believe. But you do know that there is all this excitement about apple cider vinegar.
Oh. Yes.
Also.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because I was doing a bunch of refrigerator pickles this year. And so I was buying a fair amount of apple cider vinegar. And I thought, boy, this is kind of spendy when I have this giant, very productive apple tree. So this year, I want to be able to make my own apple cider vinegar so that I can use it for pickling next year.
Sorry, and also honey, other things. You can't. What? It is not acidic enough. You have to. Oh. You have to be careful when you're canning that you get a 5% acetic value vinegar. So they don't recommend that because you have no way of controlling that when you make your own apple cider vinegar.
Well, I still want to make it because it's good for your hair. It's good for your skin.
Yes. There's so many wonderful things about it. It's antiseptic and it's so stinking easy to make. Like when you're picking your apples off your tree and you're processing them for the freezer or making pie or applesauce or whatever, you can actually make apple cider vinegar out of the core and the peeling that you're going to normally throw away. And it's fairly easy to make. Have you ever had a bottle of apple cider vinegar in your cupboard long enough for the mother to form?
I don't know about the mother, but I've certainly had some in my collection for a while.
Okay, so if you and I didn't realize this, but you know, I always try to buy the as close to organic products as possible. And so here I'm measuring out some apple cider vinegar to use for a pickling recipe of mine, and this long snotty strand comes out the top, and I'm like, what the heck? I grew a mother. So you can actually save that mother, put it in the water and the apple scraps in a great big jar. You can add a little bit of sugar if you want. Sugar, of course, is something that the mother will eat to make that apple cider vinegar vinegary. And so that's one way that you can easily make apple cider vinegar. You know, like I have a great big gallon jar. Just chop that stuff up, dissolve the a little bit of sugar. You know, it can be like if you have a gallon jar, probably as much as a half a cup or a quarter cup of sugar, depending upon, you know, how sweet you like that. Because the longer you let that set, of course, the more of that sugar will get eaten up by that mother. And then you want to make sure that when you cover the apples with the sugar water, that you press those apple scraps down under the water, because with any fermentation process, the product has to be under the water so that it doesn't get moldy. And then you taste it. And to do that, you take a straw and stick a straw in there past the mother, which will probably form on the top, and put your finger over it like you used to do with your soda pops. And you can pull out a straw full of cider vinegar and then taste it. That way you're not contaminating it with a spoon or your saliva or anything like that.
Like a couple weeks, I'm guessing?
Sometimes it happens as early as a week. Like my sauerkraut, 2 weeks and it is delicious. We canned up about, and I say canning loosely, we take it out of the crock and put it in jars. We did about 10 gallons a week ago, and then we used up the last of our cabbage and created another 10 gallons of cabbage to ferment. So my house looks like a science experiment with all this stuff around.
Well, I might be starting my mornings with a, you know, a shot of apple cider vinegar, because you're saying it if you have spiking sugar levels, it can be a good drink for the morning to, you know, deal with potential for diabetes, reduction in belly fat. My goodness, I might need to have two shots of this.
Well, right. It does something to the, it balances your, it creates your, the metabolism that you need. You know, if you slow your metabolism down or speed it up, that has an effect on how you digest food. So that somehow, apple cider vinegar counteracts sugar that creates the insulin that kind of helps balance that out. And there are studies about this. And there are also studies about how it kind of works as an appetite suppressant. You know, so you'll take a couple tablespoons in the morning, but you've got to be careful because it is acidic. And so it's best if you dilute it with some water, or put it in a cup of tea maybe, or, you know, something that you're not drinking that straight all the time, because it will actually probably harm your esophagus if you drink enough of it.
Thanks for the warning.
Yes, of course, the taste takes a little bit getting used to, you know, but a spoonful of sugar helps some medicine go down. That would work the same with apple cider vinegar, but then you're probably not getting the health benefits that you need out of that.
We check in with Sue Belcom with Main Street Eats every week. It's always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you. It's so much fun. I love you guys.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Benedictine Health System, providing health and housing services to older adults in communities across North Dakota and Minnesota. BHSHealth.org.
Race is at the core of every issue this election year, from healthcare to the economy. And for a lot of folks, that's too uncomfortable to talk about. But I'm talking about it. I'm Rebecca Carroll, the host of Come Through from WNYC Studios. Join me for conversations with brilliant thinkers and activists, Issa Rae, Don Lemon, Gabrielle Union, and others. Where is this country headed? Find out. Come Through.
Come Through. This week's Prairie Public presents Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and an author, and the creator of the Plains Folk essays he shares with us. Today, his essay is titled Deep, Deep Sea.
Oh, bury me not in the deep, deep sea. These words came faint and mournfully from the pallid lips of a youth who lay on his cabin couch from day to day.
That old Conrad Richter trope of the sea of grass, the tired cliché that the prairie is like the ocean, I never have bought into that. Evidently, it works for some people, though, and now we have this lament. Bury me not in the deep, deep sea. Showing up in a North Dakota farmhouse. It was sung, I believe, in about the year 1920, by a woman named Sarah Nielsen of Walsh County. She was some 58 years old at the time. She hailed from Ontario, where both her parents were born, too. She lived near Hoople with her husband, Thomas, also a Canadian from Ontario, and a veteran of the Klondike Gold Rush. The Nielsens were successful farmers and active community members. I have a photograph of them with family in front of their substantial two-story farmhouse. What I don't know is how Mrs. Nielsen came to possess this song she sang. I fancy her ancestry must have included a seagoing man in the days of clipper ships. More generally, where did the song come from? It is cut from the whole cloth of a poem, The Ocean Buried, that was first published in a religious newspaper, the Universalist Union, in 1839. The poet, Reverend E. H. Chapin, was an immensely popular speaker and author in New York and New England. The poem was set to music by one George N. Allen, but his melody lost popular favor, giving way to another that partook of dirge and chanty, the melody that would be sung by Mrs. Nielsen in her farmhouse. In fact, it was the tune of the traditional Scots folk song, The Parting Glass. How do I know about Mrs. Nielsen's Song of the Sea? Because she sang it, and I picture this happening over a kitchen table to a song catcher, a ballad hunter named Franz Rickaby, who had driven over from the University of North Dakota, where he was a junior faculty member. Some other day, I must speak more of the boy scholar Rickaby, forever young. Briefly, I will say, Franz Rickaby first came to my notice when I stumbled across an article in the Grand Forks Herald, 6th of August, 1919, announcing, University instructor will turn wandering minstrel on 700-mile walk to Grand Forks. Young Rickaby, a graduate of Knox College and Harvard, was reporting for instructional duties at UND by walking and hitching from Charlevoix, Michigan to Grand Forks, carrying his fiddle and collecting lumberjack ballads along the way. Actually, Rickaby had come to UND in 1918. Early the next year, he was excited to announce he had received permission to teach a course on the ballad as literature. Sometime over the next few years, he called on Mrs. Nielsen at her farmhouse. Rickaby, who with his wife Lillian were wonderfully popular at UND, stayed there only 5 years. Suffering from the residual effects of a bout with rheumatic fever, Rickaby was advised by his physician to move to a milder clime, and so he went to Pomona College in California. The move bought him only a little more time, for the charismatic professor passed away in 1925.
He had wasted and pined till o'er his brow, the death shade slowly passed, and now, when the land of his fond-loved home was nigh, they had gathered around to see him die.
That's Tom Ezern. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Prairie Public is proud to be the media sponsor of the FM Visual Artist Studio Crawl, October 3rd and 4th, noon to 6 p.m. See Fargo-Moorhead artists at work. Ask questions and perhaps be inspired to create your own art. Find a map to begin your tour at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 24th, celebrating the 100th year since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
On this date in 1914, last-minute preparations were underway in Garrison as participants set up for the Garrison Corn Show, which was organized by the Garrison Industrial Association. This was the second year of the show, and the community was preparing for the big get-together. The Bismarck Daily Tribune noted, "The merry clatter of carpenters' hammers resounds at the new corn show building, proclaiming the coming event as one of the most important in the history of Garrison. Never before has a community been aroused to active interest in agricultural affairs as that for many miles around Garrison, where the work of the Garrison Industrial Association in its campaign for more and better farmers is reaching its height in getting ready for the second annual corn show." Complete with exhibits of grain, parades, speeches and presentations, and community outreach, much was put into the affair. Like so many other events at that time, suffrage became a part of the schedule. Suffragists were busy campaigning for the upcoming statewide election in which women might be granted the right to vote, and events like the Corn Show allowed them to reach a great number of people. The local suffrage league in Garrison handed out pro-suffrage literature from a charmingly decorated booth. Mrs. Clara Darrow, president of the Votes for Women League of North Dakota, was one of the speakers, and Mr. Gaius Woolwedge, a lawyer from Minot, also delivered a suffrage address. It was reported that his speech was received with tremendous enthusiasm. A report in Wahpeton read, "The recent corn show at Garrison was more of a victory for suffrage than even the most optimistic had hoped for. The parade was almost a suffrage parade, for every float, every schoolchild, and every auto and rider carried the Votes for Women pennants and badges." The anti-suffragist contingent was also invited to the corn show in Garrison. They sent an express package to Garrison for their own booth. However, when their representative, Mrs. Oliphant, arrived in town to pick up the box, she discovered that some parties unknown had rifled through it. The Noonan Miner noted, "It is said that as a result of the incident, some of the men of Garrison are planning an anti-suffrage meeting sometime early in October." This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Kamala Harris's tough questions for Brett Kavanaugh during his confirmation hearing got her a lot of attention. Could her bid to become vice president affect the role she plays in a new Supreme Court confirmation battle?
I just want Joe and Kamala to get elected. I'm pretty sure she shares my perspective on the next nominee.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, when we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, we'll talk with North Dakota's 2021 Teacher of the Year. Minot Middle School teacher Christy Reinke is in the running for the national honor. And Matt Olin will talk about The Ghost of Peter Sellers. It's a documentary about a movie that starred the late film comedian but was never released. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.